Now, there will be very little today about Gelfand and Weber's problems. It will be more about geometry and analysis for the following reasons. So last time, we said that basically what you have is the following. We have a set of Riemann manifolds with fixed boundary, and we have a space where sort of we have the data, and then we want to find out some compact classes, some conditions to have compact classes of this, on these Riemann manifolds. Now, and the crucial point was this topological lemma. So if you have F from X to Y, and X, Y are Hausdorff compacts, and F is continuous plus bijective, plus surjective plus injective, then it implies that F minus 1 is continuous. Okay. In our case, what we have? In our case, we have a direct map, and I will use here, just for the sake of time, it's easier to write for the heat kernel. So we have a direct map from X that we still don't know, but it lies in the space of Riemann manifolds with fixed boundary N to basically C N N cross R plus. And that is heat kernel. Heat kernel. Okay? So the goal is actually to find what will be conditions on Riemann manifold, basically on X, so that the corresponding class will be compact. Or, honestly, it will not be compact, it will be pre-compact. And since definitely I'll be running out of time, so let me put these conditions in the beginning. So we introduce the following class of Riemann manifolds. Ah, by the way, so basically, starting from here, there will be nothing about inverse problems. It will be only about Riemann manifolds. Now, and because it will be only about Riemann manifolds, I forget for a moment that I'm speaking about Riemann manifolds with given boundary, and just to speak about all Riemann manifolds, with or without boundary, but with some conditions. So definition, denoted by sigma lambda di, and honestly I need to put here M for dimensionality, but I don't do it. This is the class of Riemannian manifolds such that A, Ricci curvature of M, and Ricci curvature of dm are bounded by lambda. Now, these guys, lambda, d and di, are just some parameters that I assume to be more than zero. So Ricci curvature of m and of dm is less than lambda. B, diameter of m is less than d. And C, if you look for the mean curvature, and its norm is C01 on dm, that is less than lambda, and d, what should be d, injectivity radius of m is more than I. Okay, now let me put it, just to remind you, that k here is mean curvature of dm in m. And last time I explained that this condition about injectivity radius is actually three conditions on three possible injectivity radii in on the manifold with boundary. It's a quadratic form. Ricci curvature is quadratic form, so it's a Novus quadratic form. L infinity now is quadratic form. Now, as I say, we don't bother whether there is boundary or not. Therefore, well, if there is no boundary, this means that conditions C and this second part of conditions A are just void. Okay? And then the first theorem tells us that the class sigma, I won't put lambda in the future because of time. Sigma is precompact in C1 alpha and also W for any alpha less than 1, and W or W2P for any P less than infinity, or Gromov-Hausdorff topologies. Okay. Now, I will not speak about this one at all. I will mainly speak about C1 alpha and a little bit about Gromov-Hausdorff. Now, what also theorem 1 tells, that if we take the closure of sigma in either of this topology, it consists of Riemannian manifolds with a metric G belonging to intersection of C1 alpha for any alpha less than 1. So this is precompact. That's not compact in either of these topologies. But we can look for the closure. And then closure will be not that particularly bad. Closure with respect to any, all these topologies are equivalent. This closure will not be very bad. Actually, we come to the differentiable manifolds with the metric tensor that is from the intersection of all C1 alpha and W2P. Sorry? Yes. Yes. Oh, yes. When I'm speaking about smoothness of the manifold, I mean smoothness of the metric. So when we go to the transition function, there will be plus one smoothness. Okay. Change of coordinates will be plus one smoothness. So C1 alpha is smoothness of the metric tensor. So this means that we can make changes of coordinates as C2 alpha. Okay? Now, this theorem is actually, I would say, in a sort of generalization of the theorem that is known from, I put it 1 prime, and this theorem by Anderson in the 90s, that says exactly the same, but for the category of Riemann manifolds without boundary. So it's conditions A, C, and D, and of course, well, A is only this part. And condition C is void for the manifolds without boundary, okay? And this part of condition A is void. So the theorem of Anderson tells what happens is exactly this theorem for the category of manifolds without boundary. And I need also to put here improper coordinates. That's very important addition, improper coordinates. Because basically the play will be to find these proper coordinates. Now, the proof of the theorem will depend, roughly speaking, are we close to the boundary or on the boundary, or are we far from the boundary or on the boundary itself? So when you're looking for how the boundary behaves. And then in this case, basically, the proof is completely the same as in the Anderson case. But when we are close to the boundary, then the proof is completely different from Anderson case. I probably will tell a couple of words about when have I started? Quarter two? Yeah. I'll tell a little bit about proof. Now, let's now look. Oh, that's good. That's a good candidate for our class X of Riemann manifolds because I need to explain what does it mean convergence in these topologies. Now, C1 alpha topology, what do I mean by convergence? So I say that manifolds Mn, Gn, converge to manifold MG in C1-alpha. This means that, roughly speaking, starting from some n, there is n more than some n0, these manifolds, first of all, are diffeomorphic. These C2-alpha diffeomorphisms. So there is a diffeomorphism phi n from mn to m, and that is C2-alpha. Okay? And then if we, well, I prefer to push forward. If we push forward metric Gn, now it's on M, then it tends to G in C1 alpha. Okay. So of course, in particular, theorem implies that there is only a finite number of diffeomorphic types in this or in this compact sigma close. That's about C1 alpha topology. Let me tell a couple of words about Gromov-Hausdorff, because I think it's very important for inverse problems community. So what do we mean about Gromov-Hausdorff topology? Gromov-Hausdorff topology is valid for metric spaces. And I restrict myself at the moment for the compact metric spaces. So if you have two compact metric spaces, X with the metric dx and y with the metric dy, we say that the Gromov-Hausdorff distance is less than epsilon if there are epsilon nets of the same with the same number of points, x1, xn, that of course is part of x, and y1, yn, and that lies on y, and these are epsilon nets in x and y correspondingly. With the following property, that if you look for the distance between any pair of these points from the net, dx, xi, xj, and dy, yi, yj, then this guy will be as an epsilon for any I and j. It's not sigma, it's particular as an epsilon. Okay. So why, now, why do I think that this is important for inverse problems? There are two reasons. First of all, Gromov-Hausdorff convergence or distance, that of course is distance. Well, actually it's quasi-distance, but anyway. This Gromov-Hausdorff distance make possible to compare objects of different dimensionality. So if I look, for example, for the circle, so this S1 circle in R3, okay, and I take now a torus, I make a torus, a thin torus. Thin means that basically I turn around a circle of radius epsilon. So this is torus T epsilon. It may be solid torus or just a surface, it doesn't matter. Solid will be two-dimensional, solid will be three-dimensional, you know, just its surface will be two-dimensional. Then you can prove that although these two objects are of different dimensions, then the Gromov-Hausdorff distance is less than 4 epsilon. So this makes possible to compare objects of different dimensionality. And actually, when I speak about inverse problems, then quite often from the measurements we cannot really make conclusions about dimensionality. The simple example is like that. You have something like torus, or maybe circle, you don't know. Because if you send long waves, you always send long waves because, you know, you have some finite, some bound for the energy. So if you make torus smaller, it will be long waves. And looking at scattering data with some given error, you would not define, you couldn't determine whether it's torus or circle. Okay? So this means that if you want to develop inverse problem theory, you know, that will be stable on this sort of class of objects, you should be able to go from 2 and 3 to 1, dimension 2 and 3 to 1. Okay? That's the first observation. The second observation is very, very applied, actually. Well, what we measure in practice are numbers. Okay, we never measure functions or whichever. So what we eventually reconstruct will be numbers. So in the case of Riemann manifold, we have some numbers, and what we will construct will be some finite metric space. You have numbers, you come to numbers. You won't come to surfaces or whichever. What does it mean that this finite metric space is close to the manifold, say, that you want to reconstruct? And this means that they are close in the Gromov-Hausdorff sense. Okay? So that what you reconstruct is Gromov-Hausdorff close to the continuous object. Okay. So that's about this definition. That's about theorem one. And let us look, make conclusions from theorem one. One conclusion is very nice, another is not. Well, if you look at the lemma, what we need about F, F is our direct map, it's hit kernel. That F is continuous, it's fine. DH is continuous on the closure of sigma. Because convergence in sigma means C1 alpha convergence. And just apply Carter's theorem, Carter's perturbation theory. See? You have matrix conversion C1 alpha, then spectral gate or heat kernels on the boundary will be closed in C. So the first part is good. Continuity. Surjectivity is by definition. We're just looking on the image of this F. The problem is, however, with injectivity. And that's the problem that we're going to address. Injectivity. Well, it does look very promising. Because what we have, what do we mean injectivity? We mean that on this closure of sigma, on these additional manifolds that appear that are not anymore C infinity smooth, inverse problem is uniquely solvable. Okay? So that's what we need for injectivity. Let us try to analyze where do we need smoothness. There are 2 points. The first point was Tartaros uniqueness. Okay? And fortunately, Tartaros uniqueness is fine, because for Tartaros uniqueness, we need that metric tensor is actually a C01. We have beta. We have C1 alpha. Okay? But there was a second point, and the second point was injectivity of the map R from M to CDM. The second point was this injectivity of this boundary distance representation. And it was based upon non-branching of geodesics. Non-branching of geodesics. This injectivity was based upon non-branching of geodesics. But our metric is C1 alpha. And for any alpha, but also, and there are counterexamples. There are counterexamples. Going actually back to Hartmann, his paper of 50, which shows that there are metrics G. Well, actually, he wasn't speaking about, well, it was metrics really. Matrix G in two-dimensional case that belongs to intersection of C1 alpha. And for any alpha less than 1, the intersection with W2P for any P less than infinity, exactly our case. And the geodesics branch. So theorem one is not sufficient to prove injectivity. Okay, we'll write theorem two then. Theorem two. Which has less to do with geometry.
Well, it has.
Assume that we have Riemann manifold. And we assumed originally that G belongs to C1 alpha for some alpha, for some alpha less than 1. We can do it much worse, much, much worse than that. But since we know that C1 alpha, that's enough. Assume that M satisfies that Ricci, well, M satisfies conditions A and C of definition. So this means that Ricci curvatures are bounded and mean curvature is bounded in C01. Okay? By the way, strictly speaking, what I'm writing is local results, about regularity results. So we never use the fact that it's compact. So if it is not compact, what we need that Ricci curvature is locally bounded and second fundamental form is just Lipschitz. And then we can make then conclusion is that in proper coordinates, and again that's the clue to find proper coordinates, metric tensor belongs to C2 star. And this is second Zygmund space. Okay, let me remind you what is Zygmund space. We say that F, the function F, belongs to the first Zygmund space. That actually means the following. If you look for this, well, it's almost like Lipschitz, but not precisely. We look for this symmetric difference. You divide by x minus y, and this is less than some constant that, of course, depends upon f. So the best constant is just C1 star norm of f. So you see, it's a little, well, if it is Lipschitz, it's automatically Zygmund, but a little bit worse than Zygmund, than Lipschitz. And of course, f belongs to C2 star. That means that f and gradient f belongs to C1 star. Yes. It is C2 star. Now, as I say, you can assume that G is much worse. I just don't do it because we already know. But we need it, I mean, well, okay, I don't consider it separate theorems. It can be separate theorems. But for our goal, we already know that the metric C1 alpha for any alpha. Okay? So we can start with C1 alpha. Sorry? With the bounds on Ricci, yes. 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 Right. Yes. Yes. Of course, if you know from the beginning, that's some additional information. The Ricci is bounded. The mean curvature is bounded. That's additional information. Because we just twice differentiate, it will be C minus alpha. So C alpha minus 1. So that's additional information that gives you. It's linear, basically linear. Yes. Well, you'll see now, soon. It's just elliptical regularity result in these classes, not traditional. Or as a quasi-linear elliptical regularity result. Okay, now, why it is important? Why this safe situation? Well, it says situation for the following reasons. That we can prove, put it like lemma, if G belongs to C2 star, then geodesics do not branch. I now understand your question. From where comes this condition that A and C are satisfied? Actually, from theorem one, you can prove that limiting manifolds, although they have the metric in C1 alpha, still the conditions for Ricci curvature for a condition A to C persist. Okay? So Ricci curvature is still bounded by the same lambda, and mean curvature is bounded by the same lambda, and diameter is also bounded. Okay? So when we go to the limiting case, we know that this condition is satisfied. Okay, so why it is true? Why geodesics don't branch? It's quite simple. First of all, let us just recall two things. The first thing is Osgood's theorem. What it tells us? It tells us if you're looking for the flow, x dot equals to f of x, x of 0 is 0, is x 0? And if you assume that it denoted by omega of S, that's modulus of continuity of F, and then F, of course, is it's continuous, but it also has a modulus of continuity. Then this equation has a unique solution if this integral diverges. That's not necessary, but that's sufficient. Okay. So you see, by the way, that if F is Lipschitz, then fine, it's ds over S. So it diverges. But if S is just C alpha, it converges. Okay. So the second thing is just from the properties of Zygmund spaces, and there's the following one. That if F belongs to C1 star, then it's almost Lipschitz, well, as we could expect. So we have that modulus of continuity of F is less than constant S log S. Constant, of course, depends upon F. Just log worse than Lipschitz. And you put it together, and you see from here immediately that if it, well, I mean, of course you need to look for the by characteristics, so you differentiate ones. But you see from here that really geodesics do not branch. Okay. Here I just speak about any function from. Yes, let's put it this way. Okay. So basically, we are done. Now, we see that due to theorem one, geodesics don't branch on the closure of sigma, and therefore, R is injective, and therefore we basically can do on the closure of sigma everything we did for C infinity manifolds. So we see that the map DH from this closure of sigma or better say closure of sigma intersected with sigma n, because we fix boundary to continuous functions on the boundary. This map is injective, surjective, continuous, therefore inverse map is continuous.
So this is like an embedding theorem for
Yes. You're right. Okay, so let us now, I still have some 20 minutes, perfect. Let us tell you about something about the way to prove these theorems. And actually, the crucial thing here is that I tried to somehow to stress several times is in this word improper coordinates. So what are the proper coordinates?
Before you go on, this injectivity radius condition, is that the one you talked about yesterday? So it includes injectivity radius of the boundary as well as...
Yes. Now, proper coordinates will be boundary harmonic coordinates that I'm going to define now. Boundary harmonic coordinates. Okay. Let us start with harmonic coordinates because they are well-known in differential geometry. So harmonic coordinates will be the following thing. So harmonic coordinates, and that we use quite a lot for manifolds without boundary. Manifolds without boundary. And to my, probably Chris will tell something more precise. To my understanding, they go back to Einstein. Okay? And what is that? That's nothing, that's just harmonic coordinates. That are coordinates, well, on the coordinate patch, u in m. So I have coordinates x1, xm. I'm not a geometer, so I use m instead of n for dimension. Because it's very funny in geometry. You always have manifold M of dimension N and manifold N of dimension M. Okay? And these coordinate functions are just harmonic. So delta of xi is zero for all i's. Okay? Now, as I said, harmonic coordinates for manifolds with boundary are quite well used, and I think, to my understanding again, the first time it's used in modern geometry are actually from people from your university, the two Kasdan, right? So, and that was 81. And basically, they prove that these harmonic coordinates have a nice property, that whichever system of coordinates we took, the metric tensor will be the most regular in harmonic coordinates. So that gives us first good property of harmonic coordinates. G has maximum regularity in harmonic coordinates. Now, then it's again, I mean, harmonic coordinates for manifolds with boundary have a long history of using this theory of geometric convergence. And let me just, I think it started with Petter Petters. And it's 87. And Michael Anderson also used it in his paper to prove theorem 1 prime. And why they were useful in the theory of geometric convergence? For the following reason. That is somehow goes to the question of Adrian about elliptic regularity. It turns out that the metric tensor has property 2, its Ricci equation. So the metric tensor in harmonic coordinates satisfies Ricci equation that means the following, that if you apply Laplace operator to each component of the metric tensor, this will be some quadratic form with respect to the gradient G minus 2 Ricci
IG.
And that's where elliptic regularity works. If you know that Vg is bounded, then, well, you can get, of course, that Gij is Lipschitz, but you can get that it is C2 star. Quasi. But for bootstrap arguments, it's not really important. Well, at least when you a priori assume that G is from C1 alpha. If you a priori assume less, then it is important, yes. Okay, so if Ricci IJ is bounded, then GIJ, well, strictly speaking, it's even not C2 star, it's second BMO, but that would be C2 star. You can do a bit more. It's actually BMO with two derivatives. And that's what actually was used to sort of to bootstrap smoothness arguments. I mean, it wasn't used because that wasn't used in Anderson. He used that result of C1 alpha, okay? But that's also this improvement of that result of Anderson. Now we go to the boundary, and we need to somehow to tackle the question of the boundary. And it turns out, so now we need to introduce this boundary harmonic coordinates. Let's put definition. So that's our boundary. That's the U, the domain of harmonic coordinates, boundary harmonic coordinates. What is that? So we have coordinates x1, xm in U. And they're boundary harmonic if, first of all, of course, they're harmonic. So delta xi, I put here delta xi m. So it's, we are looking for the Laplace operator inside M. Is 0 for all i's. Second property is that actually xm equals to 0 defines the boundary. Not something surprising. It's just 0. And the third property is that if we restrict the first m minus 1 coordinates on the boundary, so we took y gamma, that is just x gamma on dm intersected with u, and here is gamma is up to m minus 1, then y gamma, I put like a Laplace on the boundary of y gamma is 0. So this this y's determine harmonic coordinates on the boundary. That is fine, but now we need to take care about boundary conditions, and that was quite a funny thing as well. So basically, like this following: we first work on the boundary, so we construct these y gammas, but then we want to continue them inside. So we want to solve some initial boundary, some boundary value problem, elliptic boundary value problem, for the Ricci curvature equation. And it turns out that the boundary condition will be the following. Boundary conditions. So if you take G gamma delta, so we take the guys that corresponds to these y gammas, then G gamma delta, if you stick it on the boundary, I won't try to set it with you. It is just some known metric tensor. It's known because we already constructed y gamma on the boundary. So it's known metric tensor on the boundary that goes to C2 star on DM. Okay. So So we get Dirichlet problem for G gamma beta. And from this Dirichlet problem, well, you can sort of use something, basically use theory that is described in Tribble or in Taylor. I suggest Tribble. And get from here that G alpha beta, not alpha beta, gamma beta, belongs to C2 star in M. Still, there are other components. So what to do with them? It turns out that they don't. We don't solve the Dirichlet problem for them. We solve sort of Neumann-type problem for them. Because if we go, well, if we lift the indices, and then if you leave the indices, the only thing that changes here that there's two, and this bit sort of changes a little bit, but the equation is basically the same. We have the following equation, the following boundary condition. That I can find. We have that, let's start with MM coefficient. So the normal derivative of GMM is equal to minus 2M minus 1 K, second fundamental form, GMM. So that's just, well, that's third type boundary condition homogeneous for GMM. Pull it with equation, and you get that GMM belongs to C2 star. Remember, here we use that K is from C01. Okay. Now, if you look for other components, du of G gamma M, that will be minus M minus 1 K G gamma M. And then, well, I think it's not particularly important. 1 half G M M to the power minus 1 half G gamma K partial derivative with respect to K G M M. So the other M minus 1 satisfy this boundary condition. But now we already have that GMM is from C2 star. So this guy is from C1 star. And this is all C1 alpha. So this, well, this belongs to C1 star. And again, using this sort of elliptic regularity for in Zygmund classes, we also get that G gamma M is from C2 star. And then you put it together, well, you need, because some of them up, some of them down, you need to work a little bit and get it really from here that G is from C2 star. Okay, so theorem two is proven. And this analytical part is finished. So now I'll be speaking to, again about geometry and... Right, so let us now speak a little bit about the proof of theorem one. And it is based upon some other ideas. It's actually sort of geometric regularity ideas rather than analytic regularity ideas. I believe this equation. And it is, again, used on the properties of boundary harmonic coordinates. On the properties of boundary harmonic coordinates. And the crucial lemma here is the following. This is the one that I have told now. Lemma. There are positive R that's called harmonic radius. Of course, this R will depend upon lambda G and I, such that for any M, the volume to this sigma. And any point P in M, there is a chart UX of boundary harmonic coordinates. So that's the picture. So that's our X, that this chart UX. And then we have the map X into, well, in this case, to do like that. Such that, second such that, not good style. First, you, X, and X, of course, is a harmonic coordinate in these charts. X of UX is either ball of radius R or half ball of radius R. Well, ball, of course, if we are outside of the boundary, and half ball, then we are close to the boundary. And second, the metric tensor of this harmonic coordinate is good. This means the following. That G is more than 1/2 I and less than 2 I. So, and also, it's rather smooth. So if you look for this GIJ minus delta IJ, though maybe delta J is not necessary, and you look for C2 star norm, it would be less than 2. Well, 2 is not important. You can put 25. Okay. And that's actually, if you prove this lemma, probably. Will you prove this lemma? Do you have time? No. Okay. So we won't prove this lemma. But assuming this lemma is true, that gives you the proof of theorem 1. Because that's a sort of a standard thing in differential geometry, and I think it goes back to Cheeger. I was 70. I find it in Peterson's book. 98. That's a just a book on Riemann geometry by Peter Peterson. It tells you the following. How many minutes do I have? Minus one?
Minus a half.
Minus a half. Okay, it will be minus one. It tells you the following. That if you have a collection of Riemann manifolds, compact Riemann manifolds, and say in our case of finite distance, and any point has this good regular coordinate patches, okay, so that metric tensor is bounded and they're not that particularly small, then it is pre-compact with respect to, well, in our case, C1 alpha topology for any alpha less than 1. Actually, again, if you forget about this, you need to put together patches. The situation is very simple. What is Riemann manifold? Well, that's a number of patches in Rn and then the way to glue them, so the transition function. What you have from here, the transition function, are bounded in C3 star. Yeah, because C2 star is for G, so transition function will be C3 star. Okay, you have something bounded in C3 star, then by a Schell theorem, you have convergence subsequence at any C2 alpha, and the metric will be convergent in C1 alpha. And then you just glue together this piecemeal stuff, and you come to, using the fact that, well, it's bounded, so if you have, your radiuses are bounded, so you can cover any ball by finite number of these patches. And you come to you construct a limited manifold, and automatically will be C1 alpha. Okay? And that's probably all.